life is this way. Keep moving on, keep moving on, every day. Keep moving on, keep moving on, life is this way. My day, trying to recall the things I've done and debts I have to pay. For there is one thing that I know, what you reap is what you sow. Keep moving on, keep moving on, life is this way. So Sam Cooke with Keep Moving On. A great piece of advice, if you ask me. It's what I'm trying to do. It's the title track of a 23-song compilation that was digitally remastered and released in 2003. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. You can start a conversation of your own or add your own two cents to somebody else's. It's up to you. Either way, it's all about what you think. And that's what Free Your Mind Friday, Radioland's best open forum, is all about. Now is the time for all good folk to speak their minds. Call 888-874-4888. And carpe both DM and Mike. How about that? Okay. Lots to talk about. So much to talk about. We came through the night learning a major tragedy in Nice, France. This is not going to stop. It is not going to stop. The terrorist attacks and the counter-terrorist attacks, it's just not going to stop. But somehow we have to feel that there's a way to make it stop, I guess. And that's the whole effort, is to persuade us that there is a definitive way to make it stop, as if this can be done peacefully. We're beyond that. It's just not going to happen. So let's get your thoughts and let's get rolling on things that you liked about the program this week, or stories that you wanted to talk a bit more about that were news headlines, or something entirely different altogether. It's up to you. Okay, let's start with Joel from New York. Hello, Joel. How are you?
Thank you. And how are you doing?
Fine. I'm hanging in here.
Well, that's good to hear. We all have to hang in given what we're facing these days.
We have
to laugh. I think we have to laugh as much as possible. I think you agree with me, right?
Laughter is definitely, as the Reader's Digest used to say, laughter is good medicine.
Right, right. Although I'm not so sure that the editors of Reader's Digest would care for some of the things that go on in your show.
That's for sure.
Anyway, what I'd like to do, I was thinking about a few minutes ago what I'd like to talk. There's so much to talk about, as you say, but I'd like to continue along the lines that you've been following over the past 2 weeks in dealing with the pointed inquiries of Hillary Clinton with regard to her personal finances. I thought I might be able to frame some of the things that you've said about the corruption with regard to the foundation and this online college that the Clintons connected to, which I never knew about, by the way. I thought I'd frame it by talking about their long relationship, especially Hillary's, now that she's in the public eye with Goldman Sachs, if that's all right.
Sure.
Okay. And, you know, I've been looking at Doug Henwood's very interesting study of, he's a really good writer, and it's available in paper. It's called It's My Turn, is his study of Hillary. And he sometimes wanders into, well, he sometimes wonders why she's driven to acquire so much money. And it seems that he's saying that she's driven to acquire money and at the same time emits a kind of whiff of guilt about having hoarded so much of it. And he speculates that her squeamishness about wealth is associated with the kind of Methodism that she was brought up in. But I don't know. I think that there's a lot of material that suggests that her covetousness derives from a very deep insecurity, just the opposite of, you know, her husband's freewheeling, you know, proclivities, shall we say. And an example of this is her stubborn refusal to disclose the text of her three speeches to Goldman executives in the fall of, I think it was 2013. And that seems to fit this self-destructive pattern of greed and guilt. And I think she was fortunate that she had in El Comandante Bernie too feeble a candidate to seize the advantage. Each time Sanders was asked to show a nexus, a connection, between the $675,000 that she was paid and any political favors to the financial vultures at Goldman Sachs, Sanders froze, proving rather incapable of driving a stake in the heart of a campaign, which he could have done. And a less paranoid politician would have simply released the tedious transcripts of the speeches, say on a Friday evening, to bore some New York Times readers to sleep. The real question, of course, was never about the content of the speeches. We know it was in them. But why was Goldman paying her $225,000 an hour to give them? And, you know, Goldman executives weren't huddling around Mrs. Clinton to listen to her recite the obscurantist mishmash, you know, that's usually dictated, you know, by her top economic advisors. They wanted to make sure that she was, you know, on board. And so the lavish fee from Goldman for her speeches was both a gratuity for past loyalty and a down payment on future services. And that was never brought up by candidate Sanders. And Goldman's ties to the Clintons date all the way back, I think about 30 years, around 1985, when Goldman executives began sluicing money into the newly formed Democratic Leadership Council, which for younger listeners is a kind of proto-super PAC for the advancement of neoliberalism. And behind this smokescreen, the DLC was shaking down corporations and Wall Street financiers to fund the campaigns of these business-friendly new Democrats, such as Gore and Clinton. And it served as a political launching pad for the Clintons, and it boosted them out of the obscurity of Arkansas politics into, you know, into the rarefied orbit of the Washington cocktail circuit and the Wall Street money movers. And by the time Bill had made a national name for himself in the 1988 Democratic Convention, the Clintons had made a Faustian pact with Goldman Sachs, and their political souls were cleansed of any vestiges of the primitive Southern populism that, you know, that Clinton had exploited so effortlessly during his first term as governor. And so what happened was that in 1991, when Clinton was planning his presidential run, he traveled to New York, where the Clintons tested the waters for, you know, Bill's rather improbable presidential bid. And at that dinner meeting was the Goldman chair, co-chair Robert Rubin. And Clinton made his case as a much more pliant political vessel than H.W. Bush, who many of the younger Wall Street raiders had soured on, if you remember. And Rubin emerged so impressed that he agreed to serve as one of the campaign's top economic advisors. And more crucially, Rubin soon began orchestrating a riptide of Wall Street money into the Clinton campaign chest. And with Rubin priming the pump, Clinton's campaign coffers dwarfed his rivals, if you remember, and it enabled him to survive all those sex scandals that, you know, that detonated on the eve of the New Hampshire primary. And after the election, Clinton swiftly returned the favor as he checked off one item of another on Rubin's wish list. And all of it, of course, at the expense of the few morsels that he tossed at the progressive base of the party. Same thing's going to happen again. And when the time came to do the serious business of deregulating the financial sector, Rubin became Treasury Secretary, where he oversaw, as you might remember, the implementation of NAFTA, the immiseration of the Mexican economy. He imposed shock therapy on the struggling Russian economy. He blocked the regulation of credit derivatives, and he gutted Glass-Steagall. And when he left the Treasury to cash in on his work at Citigroup, Clinton called him the greatest Secretary of the Treasury since Alexander Hamilton. And finally, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish.
Well, I just wanted to say that I remember, you know, in mid-May when Hillary announced her intention to make Bill the economic czar. Remember that? And this, to me, served to quell any anxiety that she might have been infected during the primary campaign, you know, by the Sanders virus. That means that for Wall Street, the Clintons are still as good as gold. Maybe we should say they're still as good as Goldman.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the Clintons is their greed goes way back. Their unbridled greed, unchecked greed, and unprosecuted greed. Because not only did Rubin exercise great influence in the Clinton administrations, it lingered throughout up until this day. Because Rubin brought in his whole group, including Bernanke, including Jack Lew, who was made Secretary of the Treasury. And
Larry Summers.
They have their own little club. And don't forget, it was Hillary who first learned the fine art of turning a few thousand dollars into many thousands of dollars. And that was attributed to her snazzy advice she got from a seasoned financial advisor. Not because there was insider trading going on. So this, I call both, as you know, I call Hillary and Bill Clinton the Bonnie and Clyde of politics. It is amazing to me that the country is witnessing a deeply entrenched culture of corruption with these two at the helm. And in the middle of it, we've been talking and, you know, giving chapter and verse into all these questions, the illegalities of the Clinton Foundation, the fraud that is openly being committed. And the person who is our main guide is a guy who ought to know. He was Sir Wall Street, and he brought down General Electric when he proved that General Electric was overvaluing its stock by hundreds of billions of dollars. And he says, without question, and he's been detailing it as we went along in the last series of programs we've done, that the Clintons are absolutely committing fraud and being allowed to do so with impunity. It is mind-boggling. There is no rational reason that Hillary Clinton should actually be a bona fide candidate for anything in public office, given the cloud that hangs over her. There's no rational reason that she's a contender for any kind of public office, let alone President of the United States, which means that Bill Clinton gets another shot by proxy. She was president by proxy when he was, and now that she it appears that she might very well be, we're going to get them again. The Bonnie and Clyde of politics will again present themselves as the leaders of America. But this is a level of criminality so brazen. We haven't seen this. I mean, you could say, you know, you have problems with Nixon. You have problems with all these other presidents. Okay, fine. But the level of criminality had not really been so pervasive with them. Some kind of limits, some kind of self-imposed limit as to just what they will not do. The Clintons have no such thing.
You know, your metaphor about Bonnie and Clyde, I mean, I like that metaphor, but the one difference I would see between them and those, you know, those two bank robbers in the 30s, they robbed from banks, whereas the Clintons help banks rob from us.
That That is a very important difference. Absolutely it is. But what ought to concern us is why this reluctance to really prosecute these people. What is it that they know, or what is it that they have? What is their system that makes them feel so certain, so confident that they are way above the law? And even people who are morally convinced of a different way, people like Bernie Sanders, to pretend that he is now endorsing, he has now endorsed and is now campaigning for an utterly putrid choice, and trying to persuade people to go along with that, I can't square the two. So Bernie has to do some accounting himself, and he's got to be confronted with it. How could you possibly, after stating what your campaign is about, all these high-minded ideals, this is where you end up, and this is where you propose to take your 13 million-plus votes? You've got to be kidding. And without criticism and without a fight. This is where I think the people need to fight. They need to fight Bernie publicly, and they need to shut him down, because he clearly has agreed to be used. I think he's going to have to convince himself and the people who supported him that it's all well-intentioned. He still has a kind of loyalty to the idea of the so-called revolution, and he will try to the best of his ability to safeguard those ideals. But come on, you're already in bed with the devil. So he's got to pay a price. There's no question about that. And the price, I think, is public condemnation. This is wrong, because Bernie Sanders is betrayer number four in a significant way. And the assassin of the fourth opportunity that people have had to move away from both the Republican and Democratic parties and forge a new path and create new possibilities, new political possibilities. They got to shut him down. I'm waiting to see who'll step up and start it. Thanks, Joel, for your call. Thanks for getting us started today. Jason from Mount Vernon, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing, Eucharise?
Fine, thank you. And how are you?
Well, such as yourself, hanging in there, doing well.
we have no choice now, do we? So let me ask you, what's on your mind today?
Well, I became a silent observer on many different platforms and many different events and situations, and I haven't been commenting on your show for a while because it's been a cascading tirade of a abnormal sociopathic circus being played out. And as we know, that the reason why we have Loretta Lynch not doing her job is because she is in the bottom pocket of this administration. And that's her role. It's like many African-Americans or people of color who are black who get into these roles of high caliber, from Colin Powell to Condoleezza Rice and the whatnot. They are, I would call them placeholders. They are there to capitulate to those who are in the black community and those who are conscious that, yes, we are satisfied that we have an African-American in a high places of power, but of course there's nothing behind it. There's no substance, and there's lack of will to prosecute, which is very unfortunate.
Well, I agree with you, and this was demonstrated and proven by none other than Loretta Lynch herself. When the highest law enforcement official in the country says that she would defer a decision as to whether to prosecute a former Secretary of State and current presidential candidate to the director of the FBI, as far as I know, he does not regulate these kinds of matters in the terms of, you know, the prosecution of officials. His role, as I understand it, maybe it's changed, maybe there are aspects to the FBI director's job that we don't know about, but it was stunning to say, yeah, I'm not going to do anything, but I will rely on the recommendations of peers and subordinates, because technically Director Comey reports or is accountable to Loretta Lynch as head of the Department of Justice.
Well,
now,
yes.
The point is proven right there.
True. I don't know if you recall hearing about a top witness was intending to speak and testify on the public congressional hearings against the shenanigans and the chicanery of the of the Hillary Clinton's fundraising campaign, was apparently accidentally killed. And once again, there is at least 45 to 50 individuals since the Clinton administration of Obama, at least 40 individuals who have been accidentally knocked off or killed at different precarious events, subsequently avoiding any type of exposure of the dirty deeds of the Clinton administration. This has all been reported. There's empirical evidence to this effect. You can just do a YouTube search or a online search of this information. There's a whole list. From 1 to 40, or I think 43, and this individual, I think he makes 43, 44. We all know that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and the elites, which includes the Bushes as well, and those in the political, the body politic, are getting their marching orders from the Bilderbergers, from the Business Advisory Council, from the Council of Foreign Affairs, from the United Nations Banking Complex, from the Federal Reserve and United Nations and the Council of 13 and the Committee of 300, and all, of course, these special interest societies, those who think they're making $500,000 or $250,000, and those are making far, far less than that, are making $45,000 or $10 an hour. We are under this pyramid of hierarchy.
So what do you think is going to be the near future of our relationship to a power structure that appears to be outside of our ability to influence and control?
either we get the title of the innkeeper to the circus, or I like how you phrase it, we're going to have a standby psychologist on standby to clinically diagnose these psychologically disturbed individuals as menacing and maladaptive sociopath disorders, and have them locked up. If they can't be locked up through enforcement of private bounty hunters or through law enforcement who don't do their job, the FBI, then you have the medical institutions which are mitigating or diminishing their obligations to diagnose and to observe and to write off these crooks who are sociopathic, then we have to do our own way of, we have to do a grassroots way through the Green Party or through Bernie, somehow galvanizing these people who have these credentials to diagnose these individuals as being sociopaths, as being psychopaths. And
do you feel, I should ask you, are you in any way reacting to a palpable feeling that the nature of politics in the United States has changed dramatically with the emergence of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton? And all the polls are showing the same thing. In fact, the most recent poll that I saw says that voters are extremely uncomfortable with either of them winning. They are very afraid, even. They fear where we are politically with the choices and how those choices came to be. There's a definite sense that the process has been removed from the people, that there's a whole other process that has its own momentum, has its own rules or lack of, and things are proceeding according to somebody else's plan, but not the plan that is advocated all the time about the people and about this being a participatory democracy. Do you have any palpable feeling that there has been a shift in this regard?
Certainly, from your analysis, there is a deep abnormal divide and a high, I would call it, the abnormal bizarre behavior of the body politic has shifted in overdrive of what you just described. Look, we have Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, were orchestrated or assigned or encouraged through surrogates to hijack certain public interests. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, hijacked the body politics of each respective party. Of course, one through division, and one through embracing. Trump hijacked the Republican Party, ripped it to shreds, really obliterated the Republican Party. GOP doesn't really exist anymore. It's fragmented, thanks to Donald Trump. He succeeded in that strategy of hyper-exclusionary politics. On the liberal, progressive side, Bernie Sanders hijacked the Democratic Party on the progressive movement for inclusionary politics. So the duality and the dynamic of the duality had been a strategy planned out. And, of course, because of the hijacking of Bernie and because of the hijacking of Trump, it easily ushers in a Hillary Clinton.
Wow, that's a very deep analysis right there. And you said a mouthful. I'm sure somebody's going to pick up from where you're leaving off. But thank you very much for your contribution today, Jason. Greatly appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We go to Brooklyn. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Clarence. How are you?
I'm staying in Midland. When you are fully aware of what's going on politically in this country, it's like what James Baldwin said, you're in constant rage. Black folks, unfortunately, have selective amnesia as to point out when President Obama showed that he had contempt for black people who invested in him quite heavily, as well as not caring to do justice, not to do us any favor, but just to get justice for us. Go all the way back to the case of Troy Anthony Davis, when all that young man needed was to have the Attorney General be dispatched by this president to tell those racist crackers in Savannah, Georgia, hand this young man's case over to me. This is going to be a civil rights case. They had no physical evidence that Troy Anthony Davis killed this white police officer. His poor older sister, her cancer was in remission, but because of the aggravation and humiliation that she went through after her brother had been executed, Troy Anthony Davis was executed, the cancer came back with a vengeance and took her out. But here was a man, innocent as a lamb, that this president allowed Clarence Thomas to deliver the decision should this brother be executed or not. He only wanted a new trial, and the attorney that represented him misrepresented him and let him be offered up to the wolves that don't like black people, black men in particular. So even back then with Troy Anthony Davis, President Obama showed his contempt. I didn't know until you pointed out the other day that there was a committee authorized by him with his executive orders that to look into how to remedy the problem with this police terrorism. Lo and behold, they came up with it in 2014, recommendations that he should use to alleviate, to begin to eliminate the problem, to alleviate the problem. when you said he didn't implement none of those recommendations, I said, well, what is this farce that was on last night? What is he trying to do other than playing with the people's intelligence? And that's
well,
all he's been
the whole
doing.
Thing. There seems to be, I mean, I'm at a loss for words. Why would a president go through the trouble, and this is in reaction to national outrage about this one thing, about the disproportionate numbers of African-American and Latino males who were killed by police under highly contentious and questionable circumstances and without any punishment or even satisfactory investigation of these cases. And
you
form a committee, you appoint one by executive order, a task force, including high-level officials from law enforcement were there, a broad grouping came together, and they hammered out something that included some very valuable suggestions as to what could be done to reform. I hate the word reform because, if you know, as we talk about systems, one of the things I always point out is that the reason they are systems is that they're designed to resist reform. That's why they're a system. But they did come up with something. They came up with this final report in May of last year.
Yes.
And your question is valid. Why now do we need some other new studies in order to inform the president as to what he needs to do and what he needs to tell his administration to do, what his expectations are about the performance of these federal agencies?
But see, when you said if this President Obama was to show that he was serious about making some inroads in dealing with this diabolical situation, you said, and I agree with you, they needed the police unions would jack him up. I said, yeah, this thing is quite true. You're right on target. Like Stanley Hammer hitting the nail on the head. We have no leadership in the black churches. We have no leadership in Congress. We have no leadership with the so-called militants that's out there as far as freedom fighters. One in particular, you know who I'm talking about. He was on with the president the other night at the White House. This man is such a joke.
But here's the thing, Clarence. It's clear what we don't have. What would you say we do have?
Well, we do have people like Dr. Randy Short, people like him who have, like you. We need to really have a convention, people like you, Dr. Short. Let's really put these kind of minds together to really strategize how we're going to survive. Because, you see, I'm looking at Executive Order 13603. I'm looking at how Obama allegedly has already signed it into law since 2013. Black folks will be the last to be informed that this president has a master plan to keep him indefinitely in power.
Well, you know, I've heard that, and I'm not so sure that there is such a thing, or if there is, that it would actually happen, because we ought to also recognize that the president, in these circles of power, he does not belong. He's not a member. He's not a chartered member of that circle. He is a vehicle, and a vehicle who has been empowered by popular vote. But he doesn't answer to the popular vote.
Nope.
Right. We're clear about that. The theme of my talk this week was wanting clarity. Once you have clarity about certain things, then what do? We have to get serious about this business of punishing political people who let us down. This is a perfect time to do that, and that's going to be a part of my discussion next week. We're going to be talking about it. How do we punish this party? How do we punish this system? With our votes. What is the political muscle that needs to be flexed here? and to absolutely, you cannot, you see, all of this is being done to placate people, to lull them in into a state of, to immobilize them. This is what it is all about, to give you reason to think that something is happening when it is not, just to distract you and so forth, just to get over the hump of this election and business can go on because there's nothing you can do. You do have a window here where something dramatic could be done to absolutely destroy the Democratic Party's chances of success. And it shouldn't bother anybody that it would hurt the Democratic Party or that the Republicans are going to get in. There's no differentiation between Democrats and Republicans with regard to specific top priority interests of your oppressed in this country. There's no difference. So what you do is you upset the apple cart. Absolutely, you do it.
I agree. I can't wait for next week. I got to go, but we'll talk again, okay?
All right, Clarence, thanks for your call. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. This is where you get to decide what it is we ought to be considering. Your thoughts rule the show. All right, let's go to Desiree from New York. By the way, New York is kind of winning here. What's going on? Mm-hmm. Desiree, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I've been listening to your show all week, and I want to speak on what you were talking about on clarity. And I've sent in emails, and I've mentioned things that I guess I could personally do or what people could do. But I think I want to say that clarity is the most important thing that we can do, and we should nourish that clarity. And I guess what I struggle with is trying to, I mean, I'm here and I'm at work right now, but I'm trying to work, I'm trying to live my life, pay my bills, do all of these things, and listen to you, and listen to these shows, and to educate myself and do all of these things. And I want to say I'm personally in a movement towards eating better quality food, cleaning my water, being more authoritative in the news that I listen to, finding out what's going on. But in a collective movement, in a collective way to try and bring all of us together on that way, it's really hard. And I guess, What would you do? Like, where would you go? Where do you get your news? Where do you get your information? Because the information is out there, but I feel like your last caller, you spoke about, I mean, so many people, we have the internet, but so many people spend their time watching what's on with the Kardashians or going on to, I mean, I like World Star Hip Hop. I go to it myself, but I mean, there's so many dumb. Not I don't want to say dumb, but there's so many things that detract us from finding the truth and leading better lives. I don't know what else more to say. But
well, I think you're absolutely right, and this is the whole thing. A part of the clarity that you have achieved is exactly that. You cannot derive a sense of purpose, really, just depending on media that is driven by advertising and driven by sensationalism and other things, you know, just silly stuff. But also you have to have a point of clarity about why that is happening, too. You have a need. Perhaps it's because things are so distressing and so stressful that you find that the greater the severity of distress, the more you would find silly things that are designed to distract. So maybe that's a measure of just how stressed out people are in the United States. It's not accidental, for example, that the the biggest grossing film so far has been a film about, Dora, I think it is, or what, Finding whatever the name of the fish is. And now we have The Secret Life of Pets, making hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, it's a cartoon. But there's something happening in the psyche, not just of America, but much of the world, where there is so much stress, there's so much anxiety, there's so much fear, that people are longing for escape and for an alternate reality that just does not require them to be in contact with their fear and stress 24/7.
I'd like to add that too.
A reflection of it, I think.
Yeah, and not only just with movies. I mean, you could look at this in daily life. How many people are so stressed that they work all the time, and then they find solace in food. They find solace in medications. They try to medicate their woes away, but only just end up dulling their minds, being more tired, not having energy. I mean, like you said, I don't want to take up much time, but there's a system. I think the system is a really great system, because the system won't change, like you said, but the longer you are in the system and you don't get this clarity and you continue to let yourself be bombarded by other distractions, once you start to see it, you'll say, hey, you know what? Maybe this requisite of 9-to-5 jobs is meant to keep me in this robotic state, to keep me from working so hard that I don't have time to go home and maybe listen to the archives of Lead Stories and see what actually went on today. Like things like this. I mean, honestly, if I could, I'd love to live off the grid, get my own island, and just be away from everyone. But maybe this could be a topic of later discussion, like where to go now. Like, okay, Trump now is the president, so where can we all flee to go to live easier, happier lives?
But if I follow your premise that you started today on, the fact is, as the saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. You take yourself wherever you go. So is it a change of environment that is supposed to necessarily change you? No. It is about getting clarity about who you are, what you're here for, what you're supposed to be doing to satisfy that cosmic command of what it is you're supposed to be doing, and to just be on the journey, but always being aware that your nice, modest little plan comes into contact all the time with the bigger plan to make sure that your little plan just does not happen. Your plan has some really nice ideals, and it's probably going to conflict with what the larger plan is. You got to be clear about what it is, or try to be clear about your relationship to this thing called the system, and how best to gird yourself and to guard yourself against its power. It has awesome power. And if we, the point of our discussions is, if each of us contributes a certain amount of our power, we all have power, as a result of the clarity that we can arrive at together about this common enemy that we have, what then can we do? How can we achieve some kind of parity in terms of power with the system to keep it in check so that it does not overrun us all the time, and does behave in a very different way? But you're on a good journey. And that's in itself a victory.
I have you at the helm of helping me wander through here. So thank you so much. And you have a beautiful weekend.
Thank you so much for calling and contributing to the discussion today. Thank you so much for that. Pat from Brooklyn. What have you to say, Pat, from Brooklyn?
How you doing, Miss Lee? How's everything?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little stuffy, but I'm good. You may ask a question to Clarence, and you ask, what can we do? And you asked this question before, and I'm going to say the same thing. What we can do is, you say, punish them, jump ship.
Jump ship. Now, all right. Okay. Jump ship. Two words. Now, tell us about those two words and what those two words mean.
Well, when I say jump ship, 100 years ago, we were in the Republican Party. Now, 100 years later, we're in the Democratic Party. Let's jump ship. Let's get out of this whole duopoly. Let's not play their game. The young people, they have courage. The older people have clarity. Let's put the two together. That's what we can do. We can do that.
All right. Take it a little further for us here.
Well, I'm trying to piggyback. I'm just trying to Clarence laid down some things. I'm just trying to continue. When he talked about some of our civic leaders and our religious leaders, unfortunately, and I'm going to use the term unfortunately, they're not going to be the answer. I'm going to say that. They are not going to be the answer. It's going to be homegrown. You're going to have to start literally raising people up from a younger generation to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know what, we're going to give you the ability to move us forward, because you can't go with what's there already. This whole thing about joining the Democrat and the lesser of the two evils, that philosophy does not work for us, hasn't worked for us. So I know that that's what the old heads are telling the young generation. So we have to speak another language. We have to jump ship. We have to, A, create first, get off the Democratic Party. If they're going to win, let them win without us. That's the punishment. We're not going to be a part of that anymore. Secondly, we have to start to come together and create our own political party. That's the second thing we have to do. And like I said before, these young people, they have the courage. These are some warriors out here, but they don't have clarity. I do understand that. They don't have the clarity. People like yourself, people like Brother Alton Maddox, y'all have the clarity. If we can put the two together, we can make a move on this. We can get ourselves out of this predicament. And that's what I like to say on that note.
Okay, but let me ask you one more question. Let's assume there is this miraculous thing that happens and people get clarity in sufficient numbers to do exactly what you're saying, jumping ship and raising the next generation of leaders. What do you do in the meantime when there is a strategic opportunity that you have to or you should use to make your point?
I tell you one thing. What could happen? What if we all do a write-in right now? Right now. Just right now. Strategically. Just do a write-in. That would, in fact, give the opposing side, whether it be the Republican or the Democrat, I don't think they're going to be part of this. You know, just give them something to go at, then maybe we're moving in another direction. We do a write-in. We could do a national write-in.
Well, I got to tell you, you have some interesting ideas here, Pat. And hopefully somebody's listening to you who would say, well, you know what, that's a pretty good idea. Let's start there. Let's use that as the kernel of an organizing effort. Because to my mind, just to tack on to what you were saying, we can't behave like it's all over. We have the ability, and we should do something dramatic in this moment.
Yes, I agree with you.
What should that be, and how could it be done? But I hear you loud and clear, and I agree with you. I think the punishment aspect of it is very vital. I think we have to be loud about the fact, loud and deliberate about punishing this Democratic Party. We've got to be loud and about it. real loud about it. We reject you, since you have no particular record of protecting our interests. And we reject you. You have no use to us. End of story. Or you become very selective about which Democrat you ought to support, but the party you rejected. Cancel the contract publicly and say goodbye to this party. We don't need you. Thanks a lot for calling today, Pat. From Hartford, Brian, you're on the air.
Patrice, it's great to talk to you. I've been listening. This is my first time calling you.
Thank you. Since
September 2009, I've been listening to Lee's stories, and mostly from overseas. I teach English in East Asia for many years, and I listen from there. And you're my hero.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Welcome. So what are you freeing your mind of today?
I just want to connect with all your listeners and callers because I really enjoy your show. The last couple callers I really agree with. I want to say I want to encourage people to vote third party. Keep those slots open. Even though the third party person might not get in, at least we keep those slots open for next time. Maybe people are ready next time. Another thing is we vote with our lifestyle choices and our consumer choices. So if we can put a company out of business that's a bad company, let's see if we can do it. And also get away from all that escapism and choose a healthy lifestyle for you and your family. I do. And if the food I eat, exercise instead of sitting in front of a TV, and so forth.
Well, that's great. Let me ask you about that recommendation of going to a third party that already exists. What would be the advantage of that, you think?
Okay. For instance, maybe it was 2008, a friend said to me, who are you going to vote for? And I said, depends on who's on the ballot. And he said, what do you mean? Do you mean you're not going to vote for a major party candidate? You're going to throw your vote away? And I said, I don't think it's a throwing away my vote. I said, last time on the Connecticut ballot, Ralph Nader was on the ballot. So some people voted for him. Enough people voted for him that position on the ballot, the Connecticut Independent Party presidential slot was available the next time. So in 2012, Jill Stein didn't get it, but Rocky Anderson was able to pick up that place on the ballot. And that was Ralph Nader's spot on the ballot. He kept it open for several presidential elections, and Rocky Anderson was able to get on the ballot in Connecticut because that slot was available. In New England, for instance, Rocky Anderson was able to get on the ballot in Vermont and Connecticut, and the other four New England states, Jill Stein was able to get on the ballot. But the idea is to keep that position open on the ballot. And I encourage you, I can't run in Connecticut because I'm not here most of the year, but I encourage people to run. There was a candidate on my ballot, Libertarian candidate for maybe state senator. He's a local. I looked him up. He was a local physician. I emailed him, or I sent him a, I sent him an email and a Facebook message, thanked him for running. And he got back to me. He says he's only running to keep that space open on the ballot for the Libertarian Party. So same idea.
It's about starting somewhere, and more importantly, it's about defining success very differently. Now, people think winning, meaning the numerical winning, is the important fight, but it really isn't. It's about if you redefine your goals, this is what was so disappointing about Sanders. We know that there was, you know, it was iffy. Just like when Jesse Jackson ran, it was iffy. What would result of his candidacy. But we were clear that it was a very, very encouraging place to start. And once, you show a pretty brave effort, it would only be a matter of time before you are as bad and big as the other contenders, and you therefore redefine winning. Winning is not, well, we're going to be in the White House. I mean, that is just an illusion. But if you redefine winning by defining some strategic goals that must be achieved for the Green Party, for example, and this is disappointing about the Green Party, it should be on more ballots than it is now.
Yeah, I can't understand that. I can't understand why they're not on 50, 49, or 50 ballots.
That is a
question.
I don't
know how they can't get on Connecticut. Well, it's tough to get on the Connecticut ballot.
But it's a question that raises the matter of, you know, the organizational issues within the party. You can't hope to make a solid dent if you're in just a few states on the ballot in just a few states.
Right.
It's just not going to work. So you have a responsibility if you
ballot.
Take like this. If you have
the idea of
being a third party, you got to energize yourself and give people a reason to feel that their votes are going to count. When in the very beginning stages, you know, it's a gamble. But it has matured to a level at this point where it ought to be functioning differently. And it ought to be certainly on more ballots. I think they're only in about 20 ballots throughout the country. So that's not very, very confidence-inducing.
Connecticut, we now have on almost every candidate for every office, there is a Connecticut Independent Party candidate, and there's a Working Party's candidate. And the Republicans have taken over those independent spots, and the Democrats have those Working Party spots. But at least I can vote for a candidate, and I can vote Working Party instead of Democrat. And
well,
that's
a plan. And it takes a bit of thinking to come to that kind of sophisticated planning. And I congratulate you for that.
Another thing, Brian,
I'm so sorry, but we're out of time for today. We've come to the end of the program. I want to thank all of you for contributing so meaningfully and at such a high level always. It makes me so proud that you share your thoughts, very intimate thoughts, but you share them freely and bravely and with great respect. I thank you so much for that. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. Always something new to learn from him. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. This is The Weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life. Absolutely avoid people who don't. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye.
Brother, mind out what you do and how you treat your fellow man. If you knew like me, you'd try and live the very best you can. For if you spread good all around, you'll be able to sleep when the sun goes down. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, so keep moving.